major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the center. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute that encourages excellence in scholarship and affirms the importance of the humanities in American life.
The animal kingdom is often a place where people, or when they write about the animal kingdom, people often directly express kinds of differentiations, attitudes about relationships between groups that...
About themselves.
That they believe but won't express quite so directly,
right,
vis-a-vis the human world.
He was a man of simple beginnings, social beginnings, and he never grew up to the eminence of his actual position as a great leading scientist of Victorian Britain. He always felt somewhat threatened by his most immediate colleagues, their discoveries, and even by the younger generation that grew up around him and behind him.
Science and Society in Victorian England, this week on Soundings. First, Harriet Ritvoe of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology discusses animal classification and Victorian culture. Following that, Nicholas Rupke of the Australian National University discusses Richard Owen, whom he calls a principal scientific museum man in Victorian England. During her recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Harriet Ritvoe worked on a study of animal classification in 19th century England. According to Harriet Ritvoe, Victorian society is important as a focal point for examining the claims of modern science, because of its then-global military, economic, and social prominence. Here is Harriet Ritvoe.
Certainly, you can see the whole project of Enlightenment science as a kind of assertion of human authority over nature,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily the physical kind that we see in, say, the transformations of the Industrial Revolution,
right,
that are going on at the same time,
mm-hmm.
and not necessarily the political appropriation that is... one of the other effects of, say, the voyages of exploration that happened in the 18th century and the 19th century, but a kind of extension of the claim that's implicit in Genesis, where Adam's ability to name the animals is, in a sense, a metaphor for his power over them.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that. Here you're working on a project about classification and taxonomy. If I name it, do I control it?
Well, people often seem to think that, and in fact, the major, or what is usually taken to be the major taxonomical development of the 18th century, which of course is associated with Sweden,
mm-hmm.
and not with England, that is to say, the work of Linnaeus, in a sense, makes that claim, and that's why it was and has been so celebrated, the claim that by figuring out exactly the one name for each thing, you know where it fits, you know how the world is organized.
Yeah, but that is very arbitrary, is it not? That allows for a lot of slippage between the word and the thing.
Well, it certainly does, and in fact, Linnaeus's specific method of classifying things was very rapidly superseded. And in fact, if you look at the way his system was applied or claimed to be applied in the 18th century by people who often claim to be his followers, you find that in fact, the primary claim, that is by giving a plant or an animal a binomial Latinate tag, you would obviate the kind of confusion that people associated with vernacular terminology and so forth, is utterly untrue. That is a standard feature of natural history catalogs in the late 18th century and into the 19th century was what they called a synonyma,
mm-hmm.
that headed each entry. And that would have all the names that the same animal or plant was called by all different naturalists. And it could run to 25 or 30.
What you're doing here is pretty dangerous, is it not? You're attacking the priesthood of science, or you're asking us to question it, to look at its foundations. Am I right?
Well, I'm suggesting that that certainly priesthood of science is not the way that I characterize those people.
Uh-huh. They're not separate, as you say. They're part of the culture.
That's right, and that we should expect that the way they organize that piece of the world that they study professionally as scientists should not be that different than the way they organize the rest of their lives.
Well, let's be rather more specific, Harriet Ritvall. How much of the classification of the animal kingdom, mammals, again, you say that's where you're putting a lot of your attention, how much of that has endured scientifically? How much of that work still makes sense to scientists today? They look back on it and they say, here's a respectable foundation for what we do?
Oh, most of it, most of our big categories have been established for a long time. I mean, not so much by Aristotle when you get to breaking it down, mm-hmm. but certainly, say, primates, that's a category that I believe Linnaeus was the first one to give that name to.
Mm-hmm.
The other orders are mostly old. I mean, I should say that none of this is written in stone, even still, that the divisions between different orders, classes, certainly genera, species, are still the subject of discussion among scientists, even in relatively well-known groups.
There is what you call a strategy of domination and control. Again, we're back to Adam in the Garden of Eden, naming things and having dominion over things.
It's also connected to politics in a kind of superficial way.
How do you mean?
That is, the scramble for new places in the 18th and especially the 19th century, the spread of colonization and so forth.
The geographical spread.
That's right. Meant that whatever country in Europe claimed a particular country in Asia or Africa or South America would also have access to its wildlife. Its scientists would be able to describe it and in some sense own it, since the namer of a species gets their name attached to the species name in certain contexts.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, the institutions that in a way were the physical embodiment of this taxonomical activity, that is to say the national museums, also were kinds of treasure houses. For example, the British Museum of Natural History.
Right. With whom we associate what, Richard Owen?
Yes, certainly.
Uh-huh.
That museum, it was frequently said, especially in the later part of the 19th century, possessed the largest collection of what are called type specimens, the described original species specimen of any museum in the world.
So the museum, for example, would have not only a scientific function, it had a larger cultural, anthropological function.
Well, not cultural and anthropological in this sense so much, but a competitive political and diplomatic function. And in fact, if you look at the parliamentary debates about funding for these national institutions, you often see appeals to, we need a museum that will properly express our position in the world.
Uh-huh.
Or you see, for example...
Well, that must be the basis for all these museums that we see up in Washington, D.C. We're on the right track?
Oh, yeah, you could say so, yeah. Uh-huh. Or if you want to say... In a non-public institution, for example, the London Zoo, which has always been a private, or which was founded as a private institution, there was a desire often expressed to have complete series of animals, not just a horse and a wild donkey, but every kind of wild equine.
The complete picture.
The complete picture. Uh-huh. And... again, it was often competitively expressed, this desire to show everything. I think let me take two kinds of examples where in the 18th and 19th century you can see these things displayed, and they attract a great deal of interest on the part of both scientists and non-scientists. Now, one kind might be a hermaphrodite, or it might be Siamese twins, or animals with eight legs.
Mm-hmm.
And these seem to be violations of the established order of nature that are in effect jumbling or reduplication of categories. And they often appeal to almost a prurient curiosity. Certainly, when I've read scientific publications about hermaphrodites, I've often had to be careful where I left the book open in a library when I've gone to lunch, because right. I didn't want to offend anybody.
Right.
But
I see what your drift here is not so much the sexual and the explicit as the deviation from the norm, that which we call regular and the things that we're familiar with.
And there seems to have been both a kind of interest in difference and a sense that these things could be explained.
Huh.
And in a way, from these kind of phenomena, it seems as though the interest of the lay public and the interest of the scientists was really very continuous. But there's also another category of monsters that includes, for example, mermaids.
Mm-hmm. The fabulous.
Or sea serpents,
uh-huh.
where the interest of scientists and non-scientists seems to have been opposed. That is, for example, there is quite a famous mermaid that made the rounds in London in the, I think, late teens and early 20s of the 19th century, had been brought from the East Indies. And it was a fabrication. It was, I think, the bottom was a salmon and the top was a monkey. It was shown in the backs of taverns, and people came and paid admission to see it. It was the subject of a lawsuit because the man who was the proprietor of it had sold his ship and gotten the monster in return, but he had a partner who he didn't cut in on the proceeds. So the partner sued.
Right.
And part of the lawsuit was to do with whether this thing was real.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the law decided it didn't matter, but it was worth the while of some rather distinguished scientists associated with the Royal College of Surgeons to testify.
Here's a footnote to our conversation, Harriet Ritvaux. Again, you are a professor of humanities at MIT. Do these people you hang around with believe in this two cultures stuff? You know, the sort of the humanists and the scientists? Is that all? Did that simply form the basis for a novel and everybody's forgotten about it and moved beyond it?
You would certainly have to say that being a humanist at MIT makes you aware of the structure of disciplines in American academia that, for example, is not available to you in a liberal arts university. But I would have to say that that's another very long story, and I wouldn't want to summarize it here.
Harriet Ritvaux teaches at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. During her recent fellowship year at the center, Harriet Ritvaux worked on a study of animal classification in 19th century British science. Soundings on Victorian Science and Society continues. My guest now is Nicholas Rupke of the Australian National University. During his recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Nicholas Rupke worked on a study of Richard Owen, a prominent Victorian scientist and museum man. Here is Nicholas Rupke.
When we talk about scientists, naturalists, of previous centuries, of previous ages, we tend to just focus on their theories.
Huh.
That I'm doing too with Owen, but at the same time, I'm also focusing on the institutional context of his life, of his career. Where did he work? What job did he hold? How did he earn his money?
Well, tell me about those things. In very broad strokes, trace the arc of Richard Owen's career for me as a scientist and as a museum man.
Well, he began as assistant curator at the Hunterian Museum. Now, the Hunterian Museum was attached to the Royal College of Surgeons in England. And they had a wonderful collection, not only of medical specimens, medical preparations, but increasingly, too, of geological ones, of paleontological ones. Owen felt that at the Hunterian Museum, his style became increasingly cramped because his ambition was not just to manage a a surgical museum, a medical museum, but he wanted a national museum of natural history. So increasingly, he looked towards the natural history collections at the British Museum, which at that time were still with all the other collections, antiquities and art, fine arts, in the Bloomsbury Museum, that temple-like building in Bloomsbury.
So Bloomsbury has a fame before the Bloomsbury Group makes it famous.
It certainly did, certainly to the natural to the natural historians of the period. But that building became so crowded, so congested, that Owen led a movement to establish a separate museum of natural history, which finally was built in South Kensington in London, and every visitor to that part of the world may have admired the cathedral-like structure that finally opened its doors in 1881, it was, I believe, in the early 80s anyhow. And that museum, I think, should be seen as the crowning glory to Owen's career as a museum man.
In what way, Nicholas Rupke? The additions to the collection, the theorizing that he did scientifically in that setting? What exactly?
On top of that, too, yes. But on the first basic level, simply the enormously difficult political process of getting a museum like that accepted by the government as an idea, and then fund it as well.
It sounds as though you're describing Richard Owen as among the first, if not the first, scientist who takes on a deliberately public life in his enterprise as a scientist.
That is correct. He saw himself as a member of a first generation of scientific civil servants. A prominent other example of the same period would be the Astronomer Royal, Airy. But Owen, too, was an employee, a government employee, and he saw himself as being useful to the country. Maybe just one little anecdote to illustrate this. This was towards the end of his career in the 1880s. He was invited to examine the evidence of a murder case. And he applied a microscopic technique, the examination of a bullet, in order to establish whether indeed the bullet had been shot by the gun that was owned by the alleged murderer. We know this, of course, from later forensic science as an elementary technique, but he was one of the early people who introduced this.
Well, don't keep us in suspense. Did he get the suspect convicted or off the hook?
He was hung.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
It sounds like Arthur Conan Doyle at work here.
Well, yes, Arthur Conan Doyle follows soon on this, you know, after this period.
Tell me about some of, talk to me for a moment, Nicholas Rupke, about Richard Owen's scientific successes. What kinds of things was he noteworthy for as a Victorian scientist? Why do we remember him today?
Well, there was an enormous range of animals that he dealt with, both living and extinct. He was particularly interested in the Australian fauna, both there also living and extinct. So many of his papers are original first descriptions of Australian animals. But at home too, he was the person who described a number of what we now know as dinosaurs. He actually invented a word.
No
coined a term.
So here's the man at whose doorstep we can put this term.
That is right.
And what did the word mean to him? Large lizard, was that it?
That's right. Terrible or giant or large lizard. That's right. He too wrote the first paper of the Archaeopteryx, the lizard bird, which he acquired for the British Museum, buying it from German collectors. But probably, although we know about dinosaurs best and Archaeopteryxes too, but what made him most famous in his own day was the reconstruction from just a fragment of a thigh bone of an extinct ostrich-like bird from New Zealand, which he called the Nainonis, or Moa in local terms. This actually became such a sensational instance of the reconstruction of a extinct beast from just fragmentary evidence, that the story of his moa became somewhat mythologized, and as an historian I'm toning it down a little bit, but nevertheless it was an extraordinary accomplishment.
Are they accurate? Do they remain accurate models of dinosaurs?
Surprisingly not. Uh-huh. They look certainly prehistoric. They look like terrible lizards. They look like dinosaurs. But their accuracy is flawed, to be quite honest.
Nicholas Robke, what about Richard Owen's theoretical approaches to science? You told me before our taping that he used a couple of 50-cent terms, functional and transcendental anatomy. What in the world does that mean?
Well, when Owen began his anatomical work, he was part of a tradition identified with the great French anatomist and paleontologist Cuvier. He was a Cuvierian. And the approach that Cuvier and his followers applied to the study of animals was functional anatomy. What one was interested in was to explain form by its function.
How did it work, in other words?
That is correct. So one very good example of this was the giant ground sloth discovered in the late 18th, early 19th century in South America called the Megatherium. Mm. It looked monstrous. It looked very odd. Its claws in particular looked almost disfigured. But they explained those forms by the animal's habitat, by its function. In other words,
and by contrast, transcendental anatomy. What?
Now, transcendental anatomy.
Where are you going to take us with that?
That's a little bit more difficult to understand. But the best example of transcendental anatomy comes in the form of the vertebral theory of the skull, with which the name of Goethe, the German poet, is associated. What people said was, if you look at the skull and its various bones, you may understand it in terms of the following logic, so not function but logic, namely that you can see it as a continuation of the vertebral column, as a series of vertebrae that have taken on a different shape, as related to an architectural logic, to a blueprint within which these various anatomical parts come from the same basic element, in this case, the vertebrae.
Transcendental, therefore, in terms of the word architecture implies an architect, and that in turn implies what? Some guiding intelligence, some blueprint
in
natural history.
And Owen went even further than the vertebral theory of the skull by drawing up a blueprint for all vertebrate animals, which he called the vertebrate archetype, which he interpreted indeed as a divine idea, as a divine preconception from which all vertebrate organic diversity could be understood to have developed.
All right, and what did, for example, Charles Darwin, what did he say to support that or contradict it?
Well, during the two decades, the 40s and 50s, that Owen developed the theory, Darwin did not react to it. Uh-huh. Just when Darwin came out with his own theory, he did use a great deal of Owen's work, though. the one thing that we've dealt with so far is the unity, the basic unity that Owen had managed to establish in the form of this transcendental anatomy.
And Darwin, what, took issue with that notion of unity?
No, quite the contrary. Darwin used that, and to Darwin, an archetype wasn't a divine idea as it was to Owen, but to Darwin, it was an ancestor.
I see.
A primitive ancestor. And of course, you needed to do nothing. Just with a click of the finger, you could turn Owen's archetype into an ancestor.
And in a sense, remove the element of divinity. Remove that transcendental quality.
That is right. Uh-huh. Now, and that divided the two men. So whereas Darwin then didn't use the idea of divine guidance, didn't use the idea of a directed, a teleological process of evolution. Huh. And as Owen did, he used the ideas of chance variability and the chance process of natural selection. However, because of his differences with Darwin and the Darwinians, he got a bad press. We all know that the Darwinians won, and Owen was chosen to be the black sheep of the debate, as the person around whom all the negative anti-Darwinian myths were aggregated.
Nicholas Rupke is a scholar at the Australian National University. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. During his recent fellowship year at the center, Nicholas Rupke worked on a study of Richard Owen, the Victorian scientist and museum man. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip is 27709. Ask for program number 517. That's program number 517. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip is 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about medical ethics and a staged reading of Mind and Body, an adaptation of a story by William Carlos Williams, the American physician and writer. My guests will include Eric Cassell of the Cornell University Medical School. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. Late August of the year 1789 saw the publication of the Declaration of the Rights of Man. It appeared in the wake of the French Revolution and exerted a strong influence upon 19th century politics worldwide. Late August of 1866 brought the first recorded major earthquake in North American history. It occurred at Charleston, South Carolina. Late August of 1980 saw the founding of Solidarity, the Polish trade union. Birthdays this week include the writers William Saroyan, Christopher Isherwood, and Theodore Dreiser, the politicians Geraldine Ferraro, Lyndon Johnson, and Huey Long, the physician and author Oliver Wendell Holmes, the actress Ingrid Bergman, the entertainer Michael Jackson, the electronics inventor Lee DeForest, the labor leader Walter Reuther, and the civil rights leader Roy Wilkins. This week also marks a birthday for Lucy Hayes, the spouse of America's 19th president. She was known as Lemonade Lucy because Mrs. Hayes and her husband served no alcoholic beverages at White House receptions. Finally, late August of the year 55, before the Christian era, saw the first invasion of Britain by Julius Caesar. 67 years later, in the year 12 of the Christian era, the Roman Emperor Caligula was born. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation. Naming the Beasts, conversations about 19th century British science and society, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Harriet Ritvo of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology discusses animal classification in Victorian culture. Nicholas Rupke of the Australian National University discusses Richard Owen, the prominent Victorian scientist and museum man. Naming the Beasts, Victorian Science and Society, this week on Soundings.